Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. As a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star followed by the number one to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Brady Phillips. Thank you, sir. You may begin.
Thank you, Michelle. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining this monthly climate update call. This is part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to help support informed decision-making. Again, I'm Brady Phillips with NOAA's Office of Communications in Washington, and I'll be facilitating the call today. So during the call, we'll feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question-and-answer session. During the presentations, we will be following a PowerPoint presentation that you should download at www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. That's B-R-I-E-F-I-N-G-S. Today, our first presenter is Jay Crouch, a climate scientist with NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the August U.S. and global climate reports, as well as the drought monitor released just a short time ago. The next presenter is John Nielsen-Gammon, Texas State climatologist at Texas A&M University, who will discuss some of the historic flooding and impacts from Hurricane Harvey. And our final presenter is Matthew Rosenkranz, a meteorologist and seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Nino-La Nina update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks for the coming 3 months. So our first speaker will be Jake Crouch from NOAA's NCEI. Jake?
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I'm going to start speaking to slide number 2 on the slide deck you can download from our website. Looking at global temperatures for the month of August, it was the third warmest August on record for the globe. The average temperature across land and ocean surfaces was 0.83 degrees Celsius above average. August in 2015 and August of 2016 were both warmer than this most recent August. August 2017 was also the 41st consecutive August and 392nd consecutive month that we've seen temperatures above the 20th century average. Looking at land and ocean surfaces separately, the land surface around the globe had its second warmest August, while the ocean surface had its fourth warmest August. The map on the right of the slide shows how temperatures look spatially around the world. Many areas did see record or near record warmth. We saw record warmth across the Middle East, where Bahrain had its warmest August on record. And we also saw record warmth scattered across parts of the ocean basins. On the cool side, we did have below average temperatures across much of the central U.S., as well as parts of Siberia. If you notice, the central U.S. was the coolest spot around the world during the month of August. Moving on to slide number 3 to look at year-to-date temperatures for 2017. So the January through August average temperature was 0.88 degrees Celsius above average, and this still ranks as the second warmest year-to-date on record. The graphic shows our horse race graphic, so it shows 2017 in black. And as you move from left to right, it includes the average temperature cumulatively through the year at that point. We see that 2016, that record warm year for the globe, and we also show 7 other really warm years for the global surface. So we see where we're sitting right now for August in 2017 in the second warmest place. And then we show a couple of scenarios for the rest of 2017, looking at potential temperatures for September through December. And it looks like 2017 will most likely rank as the third warmest year on record for the globe. So it'll be cooler than 2016 and 2015, but warmer than 2014. So this will also mean that the 4 warmest years for the globe have occurred over the last 4 years. Moving on to slide number 4 to look at what happened across the U.S. during August of 2017. The average temperature for the lower 48 was 72 degrees, and this is about 0.1 degrees Fahrenheit below average. This was the first below average temperature for the contiguous U.S. since February 2015. This ends a 29-month streak of record-long streak of 29 months, with the lower 48 temperature being above the 20th century average. The previous longest such streak was 16 months that occurred from June 2011 through September 2012. Looking at how temperatures broke down during the month, much of the West was really warm. Many locations across the Pacific Northwest were record warm, while a large part of the central U.S. was cooler than average, so a fairly cool end of the summer across much of the Great Plains stretching into the Midwest. Looking at precipitation, of course, the big story was Harvey, and John Nielsen Gammon will speak to that, and we see that record precipitation showing up across southeast Texas, stretching into western Louisiana. We did have wetter than average conditions across other parts of the southern plains, as well stretching into the northern plains and upper Midwest. On the dry side, we did have below average precipitation in the Pacific Northwest. That was a very warm and dry month there that contributed to near record and record high wildfire totals. And we did see below average precipitation across the Midwest, stretching into the Northeast as well. Average across the entire U.S., it was the seventh wettest August on record for the lower 48. Moving to slide number five to look at the year-to-date for the contiguous U.S., the average temperature was 2.8 degrees Fahrenheit above average for the first 8 months of the year, and this currently ranks as the third warmest year-to-date for the lower 48. The map on the left shows how temperatures broke down for the first 8 months of the year. We see much of the contiguous U.S. was warmer than average. The only exception was parts of interior Washington, where we saw near to below average temperatures. And we did see record warmth stretching across areas of the southwest into the southern plains, as well as a large part of the southeast. North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida have each been record warm for the first 8 months of 2017. Looking at precipitation, the contiguous U.S. saw 24.09 inches of precipitation for the first 8 months of the year. This was 3.38 inches above average, and we're now setting at the record wettest year-to-date so far for the lower 48. Looking at the map, we see that much of the West has seen wetter than average conditions during the year. A lot of that precipitation fell during the winter months. And we also see record and near record high precipitation totals across the Great Lakes stretching into the Northeast, as well as parts of the high plains in Colorado, and we see that record precipitation again showing up across areas of Texas and Louisiana associated with the precipitation from Hurricane Harvey. Moving on to slide number six, looking at the U.S. Drought Monitor report that was released this morning, 15.5% of the contiguous U.S. is in drought, and this is up about 3.7% since early August. We did see drought improve in the Southwest, as well as parts of the southern and northern plains. The northern plains has been dealing with a significant drought during the summer, and beneficial rainfall fell across parts of the Dakotas, kind of eating away at the eastern edge of that drought area. We did see drought conditions worsen across the northwest, parts of the northern Rockies and plains, as well as parts of the Midwest and New England. So as the drought was improving in parts of the Dakotas, the drought has been expanding westward into the Pacific Northwest. And outside of the contiguous U.S., we saw drought improve as well in western Alaska and parts of southern Puerto Rico. And with that, I will pass it off to John.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to be talking about Hurricane Harvey and the rainfall that we received in southeast Texas, southwest Louisiana in particular. So on slide seven, this is an analysis of actually the precipitation during the past month in the region, although most of it is from Hurricane Harvey, since it's been fairly dry in the region since then. This analysis is produced by the Weather Service's River Forecast Centers and is based upon radar and precipitation gauge data supplemented by satellite information where necessary. And the white area, which of course covers all of Houston and Beaumont and much of the rest of southeast Texas, is the area that received at least 20 inches of rainfall, according to this analysis. And that, of course, was primarily because Harvey maintained its circulation and moved very little over several days after making its initial landfall near Rockport, Texas. The highest totals in that region are perhaps in the 50 to even more than 60-inch range. The Weather Service offices in League City and Lake Charles have been working on looking at the highest observed totals and testing the gauges to see which reports are actually the most accurate. And we'll be following up. Several people, groups will be working on a final analysis of rainfall totals. So these values are preliminary, but they're going to be approximately correct. Now, to give you a sense of the large area affected, slide number 8 shows the same precipitation map, but overlaid on the northeast United States. And so you can see the area that received 20 to 50 plus inches of rainfall is equivalent in the size to an area spanning from New York City up to Boston. Far north is Albany, involving all of Connecticut, Rhode Island, and even Philadelphia would have picked up 20 inches if Harvey had existed in the same meteorological circumstances in that part of the country. So this is really a remarkable rainfall event. Now, to put it in perspective, I'm going to compare the rainfall totals over areas of particular size versus previous record storms within the United States. So slide number 8 shows the heaviest average rainfall totals for a 10,000 square mile area, so 100 miles on a side, for a 5-day period, which was about the length of Harvey. And I haven't shown Harvey's total here just yet. I want you to see what the previous top 10 looked like. The next highest total was a storm back in 1899 that is basically an estimate of what happened. It produced a massive flooding in southeast Texas as well. The rest of them are mostly associated with tropical storms. The flooding rainfall in Louisiana back last year shows up as fifth highest total on this map. Now, with slide number 10, I've added Harvey's total to indicate that it's literally off the charts. You might expect to break a record like this by 1 to 2 inches, but Harvey broke the preceding record for the contiguous United States by over 10 inches in terms of average rainfall over such a large area. The next slide looks at a different size area, 1,777 square miles, and you can see Harvey breaks the record for that one also, except now I've withheld the label on that last bar. So if you go to slide 12, you see that's not the maximum rainfall over 1,700 square mile area. That's the rainfall that was observed in Harris County based on an average of gauge data and radar data. And what Harris County, of course, is the county in which Houston and many of Houston's suburbs are located. And what this says is that if you took the previous wettest storms on record for the United States for producing rainfall over a county-sized area, and if you targeted that previous record storm precisely onto Harris County so that it made a bullseye on the Houston metropolitan area, it still would not have produced the same amount of rainfall in Harris County that we saw with Harvey. So while there's, of course, lots of factors contributing to the rainfall and the flooding that Harvey produced, I think it's important to see that the storm itself was well beyond anything that had occurred in the historical experience of the United States. And with that, I'll turn it over to Matt.
Good morning. This is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. The slide 13 is now going to talk about the latest status of the El Nino Southern Oscillation. The major points to take away from the this slide are that the sea surface temperatures and the ocean temperatures in general are generally below average for the East and Central Pacific, both at the surface and at depth, down to about 450, almost 500 feet. There is a large reservoir of cold water across the Central Pacific. Temperatures in that, across the Central Pacific and in that reservoir at depth, are also, they have cooled during the past month. So we are looking at them, not only are they below normal, they're actually getting more below normal. And that has resulted in a the forecast for the winter that is having increased chances of La Nina. The forecast for this winter is a 62% chance of La Nina, which is a 46 percentage point increase for a chance of La Nina as compared to this same outlook last month. So that kind of change from last month to this month in the potential for La Nina does play into a lot of the monthly and seasonal forecasts that we've issued that were issued this morning. So that's going to be a consistent theme going forward when I discuss the forecasts. Moving to slide 14, the monthly forecast for October kind of reflects some of the background conditions of potential for La Nina to have some impact, although La Nina has a very weak impact in the month of October. So the monthly forecast in October relies a lot on trend, as well as some of the shorter-term predictability measures from the dynamical models that we have, as well as sea surface temperatures around Alaska. A slow onset of sea ice is contributing to the high probabilities for above-normal temperatures in the north slope of Alaska. Trends in temperatures during October are quite strong out west, and that contributed to a high probability of over 50% chance of temperatures being above normal for most of the Rockies and all of Southwest. Dynamical models and trends get weaker as you go into the southeast and the east of the Mississippi. So there's lower probabilities for above normal temperatures across the Great Lakes and even across some of the Corn Belt and the Midwest. We did actually have some model signals for below normal temperatures in the southeast U.S., which would be consistent with the overall atmospheric pattern that we experienced and was talked about early, we experienced in August and was talked about earlier in this presentation. So we should see some of that continue a little bit into October, where we have mean high pressure over the west and mean lower pressure over the east, resulting in some cooler temperatures over some portions of the east coast of the eastern third of the U.S. For precipitation and the monthly forecast for October, we are forecasting an active storm track going into the Pacific Northwest and into the Alaska Panhandle, and then some mean high pressure again over the Rockies that contributed to the warm temperature forecast there. That high pressure is kind of can act like a block in the storms. So then downstream from that, over the central U.S., you kind of favor below normal temperatures as kind of the storms that come in the Pacific Northwest kind of get deflected around mean high pressure over the Rockies. Going to the seasonal forecast on slide 15, trends can play more of an impact in the seasonal forecast as you have a longer time period for the trend to act over. I also do have an impact from potential for La Nina in this a lot more heavily in this forecast. Because La Nina footprint does tend to express itself more in the month of December than it does in the month of October. So we would see that kind of transitioning, that impact kind of transitioning into this forecast. So this seasonal forecast, compared to last month, the probabilities for above normal temperatures across the from the Pacific Northwest to the Northern Plains and into the Great Lakes, even down into the middle Mississippi Valley, those probabilities for above normal temperatures are reduced compared to last month due to the increased chance for La Nina, because La Nina would support below normal temperatures across the Pacific Northwest, the Northern Rockies, and the Northern Plains, only really for the month of December. So there's a little bit of that flavor of a predicted La Nina in this forecast, but it's not completely baked in this forecast because only a third of this forecast is for the time period when La Nina has a strong footprint. But I still wanted to slate that way a little bit compared to last month. Over the southwest U.S., the trends are quite strong, as well as over the northeast U.S., the 15-year trend in temperature yields the favors above normal temperatures for this season. Trends in northern Alaska are quite strong as well, mainly from the October into early November period. Once you get into mid-November and the sea ice does actually get to the edge of the coast there, there's very little trend then from the later half of November and through December. For precipitation, Again, La Nina did play some role in this forecast. We would expect dry along the southern tier of the U.S. and the southeast, as well as a more active storm track into the Pacific Northwest. So the La Nina portion of this forecast, and the December portion of this forecast, valid period, is influenced quite by La Nina, as well as western Alaska during La Nina times is favored to have above normal precipitation. Now, with the sea ice and the more ocean coverage open in the Bering Sea and the Bering Straits, as well as the north coast of Alaska, that does allow for some slightly higher chances for more precipitation. So that also played a factor into the forecast for Alaska. Moving forward to slide 16 for the drought outlook. Again, with that active storm track into the Pacific Northwest, we're likely to see some drought relief there, especially up to the Continental Divide and maybe just a little bit over the Continental Divide into Montana. We're not expecting a lot of drought relief for the northern plains and the northern high plains in the September, October, November, December timeframe. We would have a more active storm track with La Nina more into the winter. So relief there may come, but it may not come by December 31st. It would be more of a November, December, January kind of relief in the northern plains. If we shift to the lower Mississippi Valley and into portions of the southeast and the central Gulf Coast, the forecast for dry conditions for below normal precipitation from the monthly forecast as well as the seasonal forecast result in a forecast of some drought development likely. The areas highlighted here are already experiencing a significant precipitation deficits at 30 days, and those areas are basically where the rains from Harvey didn't get there and the rains from Irma didn't get there, so they're kind of right in between the two storms, and they actually have some pretty significant precipitation deficits over the past 30 days. That's all I had. With that, I'll turn it back to Brady.
Thank you, Matthew, and we'll now take specific questions from the call participants, and again, please be sure to clearly indicate who you'd like to answer the question if possible. And Michelle, can you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question and queue up the first call? Thanks.
Thank you, Brady. Once again, if you do have any questions or comments, you may press star 1. Again, that is star 1. Brian Sullivan, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Bloomberg News. This is for Matt. I was wondering, could you tease out a little bit more, maybe a little more long range into what the La Nina, if it develops, would mean for California and its water situation?
Sure. This is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. For the water situation in California, a La Nina would favor some dry conditions across the southern portions of the state. And our longer range outlooks do have some slight increased odds for below normal precipitation across Southern California. The signals across Central California actually get to be quite weak. There's not a real strong predictor for La Nina or El Nino for the kind of central portion of California across San Francisco and right into the Reno Valley. And the signal gets wetter across the northern portions of California, basically Reno over to Eureka and northward. They would favor above normal precipitation going into the winter should La Nina develop as the La Nina outlooks are now favoring. As far as the water situation, that would portend to a higher snowpack in the around the most northernmost reservoirs, but it would not have a lot of favorable impacts for water storage for the southernmost reservoirs.
Excellent. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you. Once again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1. One moment, please. John Myers, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Hi, the Duluth News Tribune. Hey, guys, I missed a little bit of this. I'm trying to get a sense of if La Nina continues to develop, what you see of that for upper Midwest Great Lakes impact. Your October through December forecast doesn't seem to show much impact yet, but obviously that's early. But for long-term winter, do you expect an impact for upper Midwest Great Lakes area?
This is Matthew Rosenkranz from the Climate Prediction Center. Yes, should the La Nina develop and become a full-on La Nina, because right now we only have a La Nina watch, so should it fully develop, we would favor below normal temperatures across the northern plains, but at the same time also some likelihood for above normal precipitation throughout the winter. Our current winter seasonal outlooks have equal chances indicated right now because of the uncertainty related to is La Nina going to develop and then have that downstream footprint or not.
Right. Have you put a percentage on the development at this point? Is it still 50-50, or is it better or worse than that?
So this, again, this is Matthew Rosenkranz.
Yep.
If we go to slide 13, slide 13 actually has the chances for
okay.
Virginia.
There we are.
And it's 62% chance during the November, December, January timeframe, which would then kind of have a December, January, February kind of impact. That 62% chance is the highest of any single season. There are the other shoulder seasons around that are at 61%. That 62% chance for November, December, January is a 46 percentage point increase from last month's odds for a La Nina to develop during that time period.
So you're saying it's more likely now than it was last month?
Yes, it
okay.
is more likely this month.
But not definite. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Once again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1 on your telephone. Again, that is star 1 to ask a question. Once again, that is star 1 if you do have any questions.
Okay, last call for questions, star 1.
Robert Ferris, you may ask your question. Please state your company name.
Yeah, hi, this is Robert Ferris from CNBC. Thanks for doing this. I'm sorry if something was already mentioned about it, but I wanted to go back to some of those rainfall totals for Harvey and maybe just get a little bit of perspective. Because I've seen a number of different sort of rainfall totals, or, you know, there's sort of been a lot of numbers that were listed. I saw some that were saying, you know, 49 inches or something like that. So I'm just trying to get a sense of how this particular number, particularly the one on slide 10, where it's off the charts, you know, what we're measuring and how to see that in context. Thank you.
Sure. So this is John Nielsen-Gammon, Texas State climatologist at Texas A&M University. Yeah, on slide 10, we're looking at the rainfall over the largest 10,000 square mile, the rainfall total over the 10,000 square mile area that maximizes the rainfall total average. So the way that's calculated is taking the River Forecast Center's precipitation analyses that were done in near real time on a daily basis and looking at the rainfall totals exceeding over areas that exceeded successively higher rainfall amounts. So the average value over all areas that exceeded 10 inches, average over all areas exceeding 12 inches, and so forth, and then finding that area that matches up to 10,000 square miles. So that's going to include information from radar, which covers the whole area, as well as dozens of rain gauges that are available in near real time. That total is probably accurate at this point to within plus or minus 3 inches. So it's Harvey's definitely a record setter, but the actual total is going to get refined a bit. The number I showed later on slide 12 for Harris County in particular, Harris County has an exceptional rain gauge network. There's about 100 gauges that are operated by the Harris County Flood Control District, also close to radar location. And the value I've shown you is actually an average of two estimates. One is that same radar gauge combined estimate from the River Forecast Centers that I used earlier, and the other is just a straight average of all the gauge totals from the Harris County network. And those agree to each other to within a couple of inches. So, again, that's a fairly reliable number, but it'll be refined more as we go forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Once again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1. Again, that is star 1 if you do have any questions or comments.
Okay, if not, if anybody has a question, you can press star 1. If not, I will begin by closing out the call with a few reminders. I know during the call today there has been a number of questions related to El Nino and La Nina. And I know if you're looking for kind of generic images of what El Nino or La Nina does in the winter for the U.S., if you go to climate.gov/ENSO, E-N-S-O, you can get the latest El Nino watch. There's an ENSO blog, which kind of goes into a little more depth on the latest El Nino or La Nina forecasts and kind of graphic and other images and things like that. So it's a good resource to keep up front as we go into a potential La Nina this winter. Couple of other things. The September U.S. climate highlights will be released on October 6th, and the September global climate highlights will be released on October 18th. We will not have a monthly climate call next month, and that is because our colleagues at the NOAA's National Weather Service will issue its winter outlook. So that's kind of their initial look at how what the winter will hold with the coming La Nina. And again, a separate media advisory will be put out for that event, but it'll be October 19th at 11 o'clock a.m. Finally, an audio of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov media advisory site within an hour to 90 minutes of this call. And in the meantime, if you do have further questions or information needs, please feel free to email me at brady.phillips@noaa.gov. That's brady.phillips@noaa.gov. And my contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. At this time, this concludes the call. Have a great day. Thanks.
And thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time.